Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Athletics England show. We'll be here throughout Euro 2020, bringing you all the latest news and insight from inside the camp with the Athletics team of writers and special guests. Today, we're joined by Flo Lloyd-Hughes, Dan Bardell and the Athletics England correspondent Jack Pitt-Brook to look ahead to England's first game of the tournament against Croatia at Wembley on Sunday. Don't forget as well, to mark the start of Euro 2020, we're giving you the chance to access to The Athletic for just £1 a month, so you'll get all the great articles throughout the tournament for our best ever price. theathletic.com/Englandpod to sign up. athletic.com/Englandpod, and it's just £1 a month. Before we get into Sunday's game, let's look back at the history between the two sides.
It is Kieran Trippier. It is delicious! Glorious! Glorious England goal! Picture perfect! Rakitic for Veselko. Aimed in beyond Mandžukić and fired home by Perisic! Got there. So though did Perisic. Mandžukić! Croatia hit the front. Mario Mandžukić pounced. And England are hurt. And Croatia, for the first time ever, will play in a World Cup final.
Very recent history as well, of course, Jack, with the semi-final in 2018.
Yeah, so that game was obviously the biggest game that England have played since 1996, if not longer. I mean, it was an amazing occasion, and we were all very, very lucky to be there. I think it was a bit of a missed opportunity, you know. Croatia were good, but they weren't that good. Obviously, they were better than England, but England were 1-0 up with 25 minutes left. England really, I remember thinking the first half that England just looked much better than Croatia. You know, Croatia had Domagoj Vida and Dejan Lovren, I think, at centre-back, who were pretty slow, and Sterling was getting in behind. And, you know, if things had gone very slightly differently, England would have gone 2-0 up and would have won the game. So it was a missed opportunity, and I'm sure that will be very much in the minds of the players going into the game this Sunday. You know, it came up a fair bit at St George's Park yesterday in the press conferences, and the players will be looking to kind of get one back over from Croatia.
Do you feel from your memories of it, Flo, that it was a missed opportunity?
Yeah, 100% a missed opportunity. I think it was, I mean, England's whole path in that World Cup, probably towards getting absolutely smashed by France in the final, the path to get to that point was kind of paved in glory. It was actually a pretty easy path, and Croatia was a winnable game in that semi-final. And I think it is frustrating that they couldn't get over the line, but at the same time, like I said, I really don't think they would have won in that final. So is this maybe a better opportunity this time around if England are going to face better sides en route to that point? Maybe it is.
I mean, I was there and sober, and my memories are fairly sketchy of it just because so much seems to have gone on since 2018, Dan. I don't know where you watched it and what your memories are of it.
Yeah, I was sat at home and on my own. I think I actually watched it on my own, and I just remember when Trippier scored that free kick, sitting there and thinking, oh my God, it's actually going to happen. This is what it feels like for England to win a semi-final and get into a final. And then I was sat there in the second half, just sitting there all the way through thinking, I'd quite like it if England had a Luka Modric, because I just felt we didn't have any players to change it at that point. I think, no disrespect to the likes of Loftus-Cheek, Eric Dyer, I think, came on that day, but we never really got a handle on the game in the second half. And when Croatia equalised, England just couldn't get it back. It was only going to go one way. But I do think now we've progressed a lot since then. And I think there was the Nations League 3 to 4 months later that England won that kind of banished the ghosts of that game. And I look at the two sides now and I don't think Croatia have really kicked on And I think England have, I think if playing that game again, as we're obviously going to, I think England would have the players to bring on to challenge a game. So I'm actually really excited.
I think that's the key point that Dan makes there, Jack, which is how the two sides have moved on really since then. And Croatia in the main haven't, in the sense that they've had a few retirements, but they are still quite an old side. But you look at that England start. I mean, England's starting 11 that day included Dele Alli, Ashley Young, Jesse Lingard, Kieran Trippier, who we spoke about, of course. The players that came on from the bench that day, Danny Rose, Eric Dyer, Jamie Vardy and Marcus Rashford. And as Dan points out, but also on the bench was Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Fabian Dell, Phil Jones, Gary Cahill, Danny Welbeck. I mean, Three years has turned out to be a very long time in the makeup of this squad.
Yeah, hugely important. And I think, as Dan says, if anywhere, that's where England will have the edge. You know, Croatia have lost. I think Mandzukic has retired. Rakitic has retired. Modric, obviously, is still there, coming up to his 36th birthday. Whereas England have obviously had this fantastic influx of new players, many of whom, like Foden and Mount, weren't even in the squad. Grealish wasn't in the squad. Declan Rice wasn't in the squad. So England have had, you know, England are very lucky in the sense they've got all these great new players and they should come into the game with a lot more energy. That said, Croatia is obviously much more experienced at this level than this particular England team. And let's wait and see how Wembley nerves, pressure and expectation bear on the England players, because that really is, even with reduced crowds, that's one of the big question marks hanging over this England team for this tournament. And I've got no idea at this stage how that dynamic will play out.
Yeah, and not only, Flo, does it have to be different personnel, and it is different personnel, you wonder how different the style will be as well. Again, you go back to that game 3 years ago. Croatia had more possession. They had double the number of shots in total. They had double, nearly triple, actually. Well, more than triple. You'd have thought I'd be able to do the maths, wouldn't you? Basically, they had 7 shots on target and England had 2. So more than triple. I mean, the stats all favour Croatia, really, in that game.
Yeah, and what would maybe concern me is the two friendlies, although, you know, we've talked on this podcast about how they're pretty meaningless anyway. But in those two friendlies, England didn't create a ton of shots on target, a ton of kind of very clear-cut in opportunities. So that's what I worry about in this tournament, is the ghosts of old England coming back to haunt them, and this reliance on getting bailed out by late opportunities, whether it's a penalty, which we saw in the Nations League as well, or it's just sort of a late jammy goal where it bounces off someone. And England weren't like that too much at the World Cup. Obviously, there was that very late goal in the opening game against Tunisia, which was brilliant. I think it was a Harry Kane header, wasn't it? Very late on. But there was a bit more kind of assuredness to a lot of their performances. But that's what worries me this tournament, is if they have that same confidence to take the game on and control it from the off, rather than relying on those late opportunities to win a game, which is obviously extremely stressful to watch.
Flo's mentioned Harry Kane. Let's talk Kane. And a little bit later on the pod, The Athletic's Michael Cox will explain his thoughts on the Croatian team, thoughts he gave on the Zonal Marking podcast. So we'll hear from Michael a little bit later on. But when you hear the name Harry Kane, what do you all think, Dan? I say Harry Kane, what do you say?
I say cross between Alan Shearer and Teddy Sheringham. He's always been a player that fascinated me. When I was growing up, it was obviously the SAS up front, Euro 96. It was Shearer and Sheringham as the strikers. Kane can do all the things that both of them did. He's a goal scorer. He's ruthless in front of goal like Alan Shearer, but he's also got that creative aspect that Teddy Sheringham had, the drop in deep. So he's always been a player that I really, really like. And I like the way his game seems to develop each season. This season, you've seen more of him dropping into the hole and being that more creative player, but yet he still managed to have the goal output and win the golden boot in the Premier League. So yeah, I just think he's a fascinating player. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with him in the transfer market. But for now, I'm just glad I'm going to be watching him playing for England.
Flo, I say Kane, you say?
One of the best strikers in the world, a team player, and underappreciated, I think.
Jack?
Picking up on what Dan said, Kane says, this is a moment that's gone a little bit forgotten in that interview he did with Gary Neville. He talks about being Michael Jordan. And Kane basically wants to be the kind of Michael Jordan of football, as in someone who perfects his game so much that even in a team sport where generally the people are very, you know, the individuals in it doing specific jobs, he wants to be so complete in his skills that he can basically do everything that the team needs him to do on the pitch, which is quite rare for a footballer nowadays. Like, footballers generally nowadays are doing incredibly specific jobs. But Kane, I think, is aiming for completeness. So if I had one word for Kane, it would be completeness. What we've seen from him in the last year or so has been going from being the best number nine in the Premier League, which I think he's been more or less for the last sort of 7 years, into a player who's maybe not quite as explosive and dynamic, but is probably better in his all-round game. You know, first Premier League player to get top of goals and assists charts in the same season for years and years and years. And yeah, I think he's coming up to his 28th birthday. I think he's at the top of his game and still getting better.
Do England need him to drop deep, though? I mean, you've all sort of mentioned that and the development of his game. And as Jack's, you know, this completeness that he strives for.
Well, that's a really good question, because at Tottenham, it works so well because he's got Heung-min Son, who is a brilliant runner in behind. Now, for England, I mean, there have been times, for example, when England beat Spain 3-2 in Seville in October 2018, where Kane was really good in that kind of number 10 role, and he had Sterling and Rashford running beyond him, and England destroyed Spain in the first half, and they ended up winning the game 3-2. However, if you look at the best other attacking players that England have got around him now, they're not really running behind guys. They're more number 10 type players like Foden, Grealish and Mount. So you could say that, in fact, in this England team, Kane would be better off playing as a more conventional number 9 and allowing those guys to create the chances rather than coming back as a number 10, because that would mean that perhaps you'd have too many guys in the same space. So that's one of the questions Southgate's got to figure out.
Dan?
It depends on system, I would guess. I think, and who plays next to him, like Jack said, I think if we're playing three at the back and depend on who's playing at the flanks, having the two wingers, I think if it is Sterling, for example, which I would personally think it will be, him getting beyond could be something that works. But I think in the friendlies when we were playing 4-2-3-1, Grealish was playing as the 10, and I felt like Kane was got in that first game. He got into Grealish's space and was operating where Grealish wanted to operate, and I didn't think it really worked. And he wasn't really in that first friendly game at all, the Austria game. So I think much depends on the system that we play.
I agree. I think if you're going to play three up top, then it works quite well. And I think with Saka as well, I don't think he's going to start, but I think he's a great option off the bench. And I think that supports Kane well, and we saw that how Saka got his goal. But I would like to see perhaps the lineup that we had on the weekend with Kane up top instead of Calvert-Lewin, and see how that would work. But like Dan said, I do think there's a bit of too much of an overlap with Grealish and Kane potentially getting each other's way a little bit.
Yeah, this is why I probably wouldn't start Grealish, because like you say, I think Grealish is kind of a more conventional number 10, and I think he risks getting in Kane's way. I think the better balance would be he definitely have one person who runs in behind, whether that's Sterling, Rashford or Sancho. I'd probably say Sterling is the man in possession at this point, as he always starts winning the competitive games. And then the other player, I think I'd probably have Foden, because Foden actually does a bit of both. Like, he can run in behind, and he has been coming in from out wide for City this season. But at the same time, he's really good with the ball at his feet and getting and picking the ball up in tight spaces. So I think that would probably get the best balance. I get a bit annoyed when people have teams with no Rashford, no Grealish, no Rashford, no Sterling, no Sancho. Do you think that team hasn't got any pace in it?
Are you all right there, Dan? You thought you might throw something at the screen when Jack went, you wouldn't start Jack Grealish, given your Villa connections.
I mean, I'd 100% start Jack Grealish, but then I also...
No, would you?
I also completely understand what Jack's saying. The way I think Southgate's going to line up, I think there's no way that we don't play two holding midfielders in front of a back three, which I think means that Mason Mount has to play as part of the front three. So then that would worry me, because Kane would then be operating in the space that Mount wants to operate in. And I think Mount, at the moment, is the form player, is our most intelligent player. I see it being Mount and Sterling behind Kane for that first game. So obviously they've got the Sterling aspect that works, and then I'm not sure him getting in Mount's way would work.
Because that's why I think if he does play a back three, and I think he probably will, although it's quite a tight call, if he does play the three, I would like to see Mount alongside Declan Rice in the midfield too. Now, I think that's probably unlikely to happen, because I think Southgate would rather have the solidity of a Henderson, Phillips or Bellingham in there. But I think if you're having Mount as part of the front three, you haven't got enough attacking players on the pitch, because it's just Kane, Mount and one other. Whereas if hypothetically you had Mount in the midfield too, you could have Kane and two others in that front three, and you're creating more chances. But this is really the balance that Southgate's got to strike. And I think at this point, it's not clear which way it's going to go.
Yeah, I think what's also really interesting about the friendlies, because the City and Chelsea players weren't involved, you actually kind of got used to not seeing them in the team, I found. And now when I pick my 11, I haven't got James in there, I haven't got Mount in there, and it doesn't feel too strange. But we know that Southgate is a massive fan of Mason Mount and will probably lean on him a lot during this tournament. But I just feel like their absence has created this whole sort of idea of a new England in my head that doesn't even have those players involved. But obviously we know that, Southgate's been thinking about their role for some time, but it's just a strange feeling with, them not being in those games.
Jack Grealish we're recording this on a Thursday morning. Jack Grealish did the media work yesterday, Jack, and he did talk about Harry Kane in that.
Yeah, he said that Kane was the player in the England camp who he most likes talking to, who he thinks he can learn the most from. Just talked about his sort of mentality and approach and what he's like around the camp and how hard he trains and everything. Which was interesting, really, because Kane is England captain, but I think lots of people don't necessarily have the impression of him as being an especially vocal leader compared to, say, Henderson. I think Henderson closer fits our sense of what a traditional captain should be like. But then I also think at the same time, Kane is very much a kind of lead by example kind of guy. And I think that's really why he's so important to Grealish.
But there is actually, and maybe Kane is at the forefront of this, but Henderson and Maguire as well. And there may be, and Sterling actually as a leadership group. I go back 5 years now, Flo, and sitting in Paris ahead of the Euros in 2016 and having an awful lot of former players tell me in shows that I did back then saying they've got no leaders, this England team. They've got absolutely no leaders. 5 years on, they do.
Yeah, and it's crucial. And I think, you know, we've talked a lot about how that is Southgate's best aspect. He might not be the world's best coach, but his man management is unbelievable. And you can tell how much the players love him, how much they enjoy being part of England. I was talking to my friends yesterday because I sent them one of the videos that the England camp have done, you know, when they arrive at St. George's Park and they do a little video, whatever. And Saka was doing this joke where he was pretending that to ask for everyone's passport so they would think that they'd forgotten them. And we were talking about how all the players just look like they love this opportunity to play for England. They're so excited. Even the ones who aren't 17 look like schoolboys and they look like this is their dream. And you think back to that team in 2016 and it just looked miserable. It looked like playing in that competition was a chore for them. It wasn't an opportunity. It wasn't a dream. It was, oh, I'm on England duty and this is all just a bit depressing. And I think that is a huge difference because you want to see players who are enjoying themselves and having fun. And I think that's probably one of the biggest impacts Southgate's have is he's brought that atmosphere back and the leaders within the team are shining through because they're also creating an atmosphere that's relaxed, but importantly also takes itself seriously.
Coming back to Kane, because you've done a really big piece on Kane, Jack, ahead of this game. In this search for being complete and being quite Jordan-esque, as you were pointing out, and he's mates with Tom Brady as well, who also has, you know, another American sport icon, of course. Is he aloof, Kane, or does he join in the fun? And I don't mean aloof in being rude, but that focus, that individual focus, can sometimes take the individual out of the group.
Yeah, I think he is, Mark. I think that is my impression of him. I think he's very focused and very driven, and I don't think he's an especially extroverted person. I think he's actually quite a private person. I don't get the impression that he is the life and soul of the dressing room. I don't think he's kind of involved in all the banter and that sort of thing. Like, I'm not saying he's like he's silent, but I just think that he is, for Kane, it's all about being the best, focusing on his own game, improving every season, working as hard as he possibly can, leaving no stone unturned to perfect his game and to perform as well as possible. And that's really what it's all about. And so I can totally understand why people might have that impression of him. And I don't think that's a negative thing either. I think it's just, that is just the kind of blinders mentality he has.
I think also that the culture around being a footballer in England has changed massively. I mean, think about the England team in the sort of mid to late 2000s, early 2010s. It was all about going to nightclubs in Mayfair, dressing up, you know, dating famous people in the media as well. And we do still see that link ups with, you know, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and Perry from Little Mix and all these kind of amazing couples. But they now, all they want to do is stay at home with their dogs. You know, it's a really different lifestyle. And Kane's started having kids at a very early age. He's got, what, 3 kids now, I think? 3 or 4? I don't know. But he's young and got a lot of kids at a young age. So I think the focus and the culture of being around football in England has really drastically changed. And perhaps it's actually benefiting England, which is not necessarily that surprising. But it's just interesting how culturally we've just changed so dramatically.
Yeah, that's why. So yesterday at St George's Park, Declan Rice came out and said that he'd never drunk a pint of beer.
Yeah,
and this was taken by some people to be like, well, he's never drunk a pint of beer. But it's like, well, of course he hasn't. He's like a 23-year-old professional footballer who's given his whole life to being the best footballer he can. He's not going to go and drink pint of beer. Like, same with Harry Kane. Like, Harry Kane never drinks during the season, drinks a little bit on the off season. And that's more likely to be spirits than beer. But that should have, you know, nowadays, a footballer who does drink pints is in fact more countercultural than a footballer who doesn't drink pints. Like, it's perfectly normal and natural and right that someone in the position of Harry Kane or Declan Rice would not go and relax after a game with 7 pints of beer.
He's quite an old man, isn't he, in that dressing room as well, Harry Kane? I know it sounds stupid because he's 27, 28, but actually the squad is so young that they probably look at him as being that old man, that father figure, yeah, in the dressing room, as the captain as well. So it's quite what a weird situation for someone who actually is quite young himself.
Especially if Henderson isn't playing, because I think Henderson and Walker are the oldest in the squad, both born in 1990. I think Trippier maybe was as well. So Kane is a few years younger than those guys. But if Henderson isn't playing, then Kane certainly is. And I also think Kane has this kind of, he does have a kind of old school mentality, like we were just talking about. Like it's no coincidence that Kane was the one Tottenham player who was the most supportive of Jose Mourinho during Mourinho's time at Spurs. Because for Kane, like, he accepted the fact that the manager was putting pressure on the players and criticising the players. And he actually said in that Gary Neville interview, the issue was that Spurs didn't have enough leaders. They didn't have it to cope with Mourinho's style of management. So Kane, that's why you can draw a connection between Kane and, say, Frank Lampard, who I think had quite a similar mentality as a player. You know, it's all about, you've got to perfect your own game, you've got to take the criticism from the manager, you know, be the best player and professional you can be. So in that sense, Kane is more traditional, more old-fashioned, more old-school than some of the younger members of this England team.
What else did you discover in the course of putting the Kane piece together then?
I think Kane gets a bit of unfair stick. People on social media think Kane is incredibly apolitical and not interested in getting involved in any causes or anything, which I think is unfair. Kane, every time Kane as England captain is called to speak on about taking the knee, for example, he speaks about it very well. He also has lots of charities that he's very involved with, for example, you know, sponsoring Leighton Orient shirts with a veterans charity, helping out a local hospice, that sort of thing. But there isn't really that much, I don't think there's actually that much to know about Kane. There's not like a hidden or a secret Kane. Like he is what he looks like. He's just a very dedicated professional footballer, and his only real interests aside from that are American sports, golf, and spending time with his family. What I was trying to get at in the piece is, to what extent is Harry Kane's quest for greatness dependent on winning team trophies? Obviously he hasn't won any team trophies, as we talk about all the time, but I'm sure he will become England's greatest ever goal scorer, probably get the Premier League greatest ever goal scorer. He's got 3 Premier League golden boots already, got 1 World Cup golden boot. And so I actually spoke to Gary Lineker about this, because obviously Lineker is someone who is more famous for his individual goal scoring records than he is for the fact that he won a Copa del Rey with Barcelona and an FA Cup with Tottenham in 1991. And he said that, yeah, you know, sometimes you can't force your team to win a trophy. You know, sometimes you don't get the breaks. But as a striker, you can be objectively measured against other strikers by virtue of your goal scoring. And so in that sense, I do think that Kane is still achieving greatness, even if he's at a team that never wins.
I think that's a really interesting point, that position, Dan, you can be judged a success individually just by the number of goals you scored. If you are a left back, for argument's sake, you're less likely to be remembered for your productivity or the number of tackles you put in or how many goal line blocks you managed. Then it is put your medals on the table. But maybe that's a really interesting point, that in that one position, if you are a striker, the individual side of it can actually give you credibility, for want of a better word.
Yeah, Gary Neville, for example, I don't think he'll be remembered for his having unique traits as a fullback. He'll be remembered because of what he's won in his career. But I just find the Harry Kane and the Michael Jordan thing quite fascinating, because Michael Jordan was an individual, but he won so much as well. And that's what Harry Kane will strive to be. Jack talked about him liking his golf. That's an individual sport. Tom Brady, the quarterback, I know a lot of my NFL knowledge isn't the best, but a lot of it is obviously based around the quarterback and the quarterback being an individual. So he will go down as a great, but he'll also know that he probably needs to win something, and that's probably why he wants to leave Spurs at the moment. And he will know this is the best chance for England to win anything since maybe 2004, 2006, and he'll be getting into those around him, because Harry Kane knows this is a massive chance to be England captain and win one of the biggest trophies on the planet as the captain, and add that to all the list of things he's already done.
Is he, Flo, and this sounds ridiculous, is he in the shop window at these Euros?
Potentially. I think a bit like when Rooney was at United and there were the rumours of him going to City, and it never sort of, it obviously never happened, but I felt like that dominated so much of the media around that time. And I feel like Kane's going to have a similar situation this summer, but he's been going through that for years now. And yes, like Dan said, he does need to leave if he wants to win something, but Spurs suits him so perfectly. I mean, Jack talked about his relationship with Son and that perfect partnership. So it is hard to recreate that elsewhere. And you've got to weigh that up and take that risk as well if you're going to leave. Is, will I ever actually have a partnership like this again? Will I ever be having this free reign and having this free role and hit all these records again? So yeah, in some ways he's in the shop window, but I think he's already got that credibility. I don't think he needs to prove anything to anyone. People already want him and he knows that he's wanted. I think the onus is actually more on him than anything. It's more his decision and he has the power rather than him having to go and show off his best talents on the global stage.
Given you host the Villa pod, Dan, is Grealish in the shop window? Would you secretly like Grealish to not feature that much during this tournament?
No, you know what? Because I want the best for him in his career. And I know how hard he's worked to get to this point, to be in the England team. He's an exceptional player. I think he's a world-class player. And I'm not stupid. I know at some point he's going to move on from Villa. Obviously, I don't want it to be now because I feel like Villa are on the up. And I could do with Kane moving. I think that would be great for me. I think if Kane moves and the money in the market goes towards Man City buying Harry Kane, I think they probably don't buy Jack Grealish. So I'm hoping Kane and Foden link up superbly all the way through the tournament and Man City think, yeah, we can't miss out on that. We'll have a little bit of that ourselves.
And to round off everything to do with England here before we play Michael Cox on Croatia, is there any concern from Gareth Southgate, Jack, that various members of his England squad are the subject of transfer rumours? Or is he just used to, you know, that's what happens every summer?
He's used to it. I'd be surprised if any England players make transfers during the summer. He was asked about Kane in this context the other week, and he said, well, look, Harry Kane's incredibly professional. I'm sure that it won't distract him. It won't distract him over the course of the Euros. I know that a few months ago, Kane was hoping to get his future resolved before the Euros. Obviously, that hasn't happened. I don't think anything will happen during the Euros. You know, I think the transfer market is in a bit of a dip at the moment, and it won't come out of that until after the tournament is finished, just because the players, everyone in football is fully focused on this tournament.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The England Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Let's find out more about Croatia. Then I mentioned we were going to hear from the Athletic's Michael Cox. This is what he said on his Zonal Marking podcast. He's not a big fan of the Croatian team.
I'm not convinced by them, to be honest. I actually wasn't particularly convinced by them at the World Cup. I know they got to the final, but needed penalties against Denmark, needed penalties against Russia. Obviously, they beat England on extra time as well. They look a little bit old, if I'm being honest. They have lost a couple of players from 2018. They've brought through some decent players. I mean, Vlasic has done very well as the number 10 for the national side. Obviously, didn't see the best of him at Everton. Maybe more than any other side in the competition, have some very good passing midfielders, and I think will insist very much on dominating possession. But there are weaknesses. I think at the back they look a little bit shaky. In the World Cup, they relied a lot on Vasiliko down the right. He has had a very difficult campaign, hasn't played very much. Not too sure about Barisic, the left back either. And I think without the fullbacks, they don't get the best from the wide midfielders who want to be moving inside as well. Petkovic has done all right up front at international level. Again, we haven't seen too much of him really at the highest level. And I'm not sure whether he will step up and fill the boots of Mandzukic, who was always very reliable. So I must say, I feel like Croatia are probably on the way down. I think they've got a good chance of getting out of the group, but I don't really see them as one of the contenders here.
Michael there, Jack, talked about the midfielders that Croatia have, and obviously Luka Modric. You said last week that Calvin Phillips, England might go for him to do a job on Modric.
Yeah, I think it probably depends on Henderson's fitness, really. Obviously, Henderson played the second friendly, but you know he hasn't played a proper 90 minutes since February. That said, Phillips got injured for Leeds at the last game of the season, and then there's Bellingham as well. So I think that's really probably England's biggest selection dilemma, really, is that place. But then it depends on the system as well. You know, if England play a 4-2-3-1, they'll definitely have two holders. If they play a 3-4-3, he might be tempted to go for Rice and Moore, maybe a Mount-type player. But I guess that's really the big decision that Southgate's got to make over the next few days.
Very quickly, final one on this, Dan and Flo. If England don't win, does all hell break loose?
No, because I think actually you could end up finishing third and end up with a better pathway. Obviously, England losing any game, there's always going to be a little bit of a mini meltdown. But if you actually look at the facts of it, probably finishing first, it isn't brilliant for England. But I think England will win. I think England have progressed, and I don't think Croatia have since we last played them. And we beat them in the Nations League with a midfield of Eric Dier, Ross Barkley and Fabian Delph. So I think we've moved on even since then. So yeah, I don't think it'll be a problem.
Dan, I can't start doing pathways before the tournament. I felt like in Russia 3 years ago, I spent most of that tournament discussing whether England should lose against Belgium to finish second in that group and get the easier pathway. It felt like it dominated the whole of the group stage. Will there be a calmness then, Flo, if England don't win?
I would like to think so, but I mean, we all know from experience that it doesn't often work out that way, especially with reaction in the media. And I think as part of the media and as fans, I think you just have to be realistic. But from all the build-up has been about Croatia's weakness and England's dominance. So I think maybe that will be the biggest blow, is that the priority and the preference and the confidence is all on England now. So in other tournaments, perhaps we haven't gone in with such a win, group stage is going to be a cruise. So that's perhaps the issue.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to The England Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
On the pod earlier this week, we had George Culkin on. It was hugely emotional. He got incredibly romantic when he talked about England. So we thought we'd ask a few more of our writers to tell us what success looks like for England this summer. Here are The Athletic's Ollie Kay, Rafa Honigstein and first Ryan Conway.
What would make England successful in Euro 2020? I have a couple of questions about the balance of the squad overall, and I have some questions over the goalkeeping position. But I think across the board, particularly in the attacking areas, England are absolutely stacked. They've got a lot of depth, a lot of quality. I think when you look back on 2018 and reaching a semi-final. Of course, we all want progress to be linear, and that, we of course all know that that is never the case in anything, in any walk of life. But if they were to go one step further and make the final, I think regardless of the outcome in that game, if they were to make the final, I think that would be considered a success.
Success for England. Well, of course, the obvious answer is winning it, ending 55 years of hurt, or is it 54? I've lost track. In terms of results, success is reaching semi-finals. But you have to look at the profile of this team. It's such a young squad with the likes of Foden, Sancho, Mount, Bellingham, James, Saka going to a major tournament with only one or two seasons of senior football behind them. So I think there has to be some understanding of that. If they perform individually, collectively, in a way that makes you feel they're building towards something in 2022, 2024, 2026, that's positive. I'm wary of always saying the next tournament, the next tournament. But I do feel there's a real cause for optimism in the long term. It's just the next few weeks I worry about.
What constitutes success for England at Euro 2020/21? Well, I think after all this progress and development in recent years, it's no longer enough to talk about process and development. I think England have to go out with the attempt to win this Euro, and only winning it will be a real success. If they fall short, then you have to evaluate. I have Spain to beat England in the quarterfinals, and you really have to decide for yourself if that's a good outcome or another disappointment. Who am I to judge? I'm German. We tend to win stuff even when we're not very good.
Obviously, we're offering at the moment The Athletic for just £1 a month. So you'll get all the articles throughout the tournament for our best ever price. If you go to theathletic.com/England pod. What articles on there at the moment have caught your eye? Dan, you can go first.
Yeah, I read one this morning actually from James Horncastle. I really like his style. Even though he obviously wasn't there, I feel like when he's writing about Italy that he actually was there in 1968 or the time he was writing about. So yeah, he gives me the vibes of the old Football Italia on Channel 4. I really like the way he writes, and it was really interesting actually to see how Italy have evolved over the last few years, and I actually think they might be dark horses for the whole tournament. So yeah, I recommend that one.
Okay, Flo, what have you spotted?
I've been watching the TIFO group preview videos, and they're very soothing, and I think it's quite nice, especially if you're watching something like Mayor of Easttown or one of those thrillers that's on at the moment and it's all a bit tense. I think putting on one of those before you go to bed is very soothing. And I've also really enjoyed the preview of the Croatia side by a Croatian journalist called Ante Buskalic. I hope I haven't ruined his name. But yeah, it's a really nice kind of in-depth look at all their players, and looking as well about who stayed on from Russia as well. So yeah, definitely check that out if you want to find a bit more about the Croatian team.
Good stuff. Jack?
My favourite thing on The Athletic recently is Stu James and Laurie Whitwell did a brilliant oral history of Wales's campaign at Euro 2016, which they've spoken to everyone. They've got some fantastic voices. It includes the best anecdote involving bestiality I've ever read in an Athletic piece.
I did see that as well.
Well, I think we've covered a wide range of subjects in your recommendations. So thank you all three of you for that. Theathletic.com/England pod to sign up. Theathletic.com/England pod, and you will get all of that for just £1 a month. So before we go, the final thing we'll do is we'll get your starting 11. This is what you would do, not what you think Gareth Southgate will do for the game against Croatia. Jack, you did give us yours on Tuesday, but just remind us, and also then the producer will cross-reference to see whether you've changed your mind since Tuesday.
I'm afraid I've got to stick with the same team. So
good.
Pickford, Walker, Stones, White, Shaw, Rice, Phillips, Foden, Mount, Sterling, Kane.
Okay, excellent. Flo?
I've gone for a 3-4-3. Pickford, Walker, Stones, White. I do think, yes, you don't have a left-sided centre-back, but I just can't put Tyrone Mings in there. And I know it is probably a bit of a big decision throwing White in straight out of the deep end when 10 days ago he wasn't probably even in that final squad, but I'm going to go for it. Trippier, Bellingham, Rice, Chilwell, and then Sancho, Kane, Foden.
All right, so you'd have White as a left-sided centre-half as opposed to, say, using Luke Shaw in that position?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Dan, if you can, you know, calm down that Tyrone Mings has been left
sorry.
Out by Flo.
Apologies.
I'm going to put him in my team, so I'll go Pickford,
I thought you might.
Trippier, Stones. I've had enough of the Tyrone Mings slander on this podcast, so I'll have him at left centre-back. I'll go Shaw at left-back, then Rice and Mount is the midfield two, and then Grealish, Foden, Sancho behind Kane.
Very, very attacking. Thank you to all three of you. Thank you very much to you for listening as well. Dan and Gess are back on Sunday after that Croatia game, presumably after Mings has won man of the match, Dan.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Let's go with that. I'll be happy with that.
Thank you all. So Dan and the Gess back on Sunday after the Croatia game. See you soon.
The Athletic.